us in the Spirit here on this earth to lead us and to guide us. And as your children, God, we submit ourselves under your word and under its instruction and application. But by this Father now, in Jesus' name, amen.
Good morning. So good to be back with you. Never been to this place, but I think I've been to both sides, Tooting and Wimbledon, and you're a mix of the two, I believe. But thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate every opportunity to be here. I've become very much a part of the shofar movement in South Africa and here, and appreciate every chance I have of having fellowship, whether it is just having a coffee or whether it is being with a group in the church. I have thoroughly enjoyed being involved at the conference in Stellenbosch and again at the leaders' conference in Franschhoek, where I spoke for 2 hours. I won't repeat that today. And I was asked to speak in the same direction, not the same message, but in the same direction, dealing with family. And that is a delight for me, and I thank you for having me. I've had the privilege of just about, probably about 3 months ago, launching my biography, which covers 62 years of ministry, 52 years of marriage, and what else? And involvement in various areas, in the church, in politics, in sport, and have the grace of God and the privilege to still be walking with the Lord and to share wherever I can globally about this wonderful Lord that makes all things possible. You know, there's a word that's not in the dictionary. But I wish they had it there, because I've come to know Christ as the great interventionist. So if you can recommend it to be put in the dictionary and added to, because I always somehow find him as the God who somehow turns things around and then suddenly arrives on the scene. So I arrived at the airport the previous night, Friday night in Johannesburg, and I know there are two flights, and on the one flight I have a ticket, but my ticket, when the flight was full, two flights is full, I said, okay, I'll take a standby, but I got to be in London on Saturday. So when I got to the airport, they say that, look, there's not going to be two flights tonight. There's only going to be one flight. So there's going to be a lot of people disappointed. And I thought the fact that I'm a lifetime platinum flyer, it will still help me. But said, oh, we're not sure. All we can do is you wait and hope and pray, but we don't think it's going to happen. I said, now why did you take one flight off? They said, no, the plane was delayed in London coming back and it's not here yet. So we can't take two flights tonight. So a lot of people will have to fly Saturday, which means I come here Sunday. And so I went to go and have coffee at the airport there, and I had my son and his wife come in and have coffee with me. And just as I was waiting for them, I saw a pilot sitting there, a first officer. Could see by his stripes that he's a first officer. And I was sitting down having my cappuccino, and I just felt, let me just see what this man can do for me. And I went across to him and I said, sir, I'm terribly sorry to intrude, please forgive me, but I'm a bit desperate, and maybe you can help me somehow. I said, I got this situation, the flight is cancelled. Are you perhaps on the flight to London? He says, no, my flight is to New York. I thought, okay, I missed this one. I said, my problem is that I have a ticket, I'm on standby, but there are two plane loads of people that's got to go to London, and I want to be on the one that's going. I said, I would have asked my son for help. My son is senior first officer, but he's just gone on the flight to Mumbai, so he can't help me. So he says, okay, let me see what I can do, and I'm going to phone the operations room and just find out who is the captain on that flight that's traveling tonight. So I said, thank you so much. Whatever you can do, I'd really appreciate that. So he phones the ops room and he says, listen, I want to help somebody. He says, who's the captain on the flight to London tonight? So they said, it's Captain Leo somebody. And he says, can you give me his number? And they gave the number and he phones Captain Leo. And he says to Captain Leo, yes, a man here, he's got to preach this weekend in London. And but the one flight is off and he's about long in the bread queue to get there. I'd like to help him. And the captain says, okay, what's his name? He says, the same name as the first officer that you may know, Chris Lodewijk. And can he please use his jump seat? Because there are no seats. And when you use the jump seat, you are... There's such a thing on all airlines that if you have a family member in there, that you get screened for a jump seat. Police clears you, the FBI clears you, sort of that you know hijacker or something. And then you get a jump seat permit and it's for life. And I have a jump seat pilot permit. And so I said, I'm prepared to sit anywhere as long as I can get on that plane. So the captain comes back to him later and he says, tell this gentleman that he can get on the plane on a jump seat and I'll make one of the bunks available to him from one of the pilots. Or he'll have to sit on a jump seat. Now a jump seat is that seat that you see by the exit. Either in the cockpit, behind the pilot, there's a little seat, small little seat. Now to sit on that for 11 hours, you know, I'm wondering, okay, but I'm going to get there. So later I'm admitted and I get to the plane and they said, I must just wait and see whether I'm going to sit on that little seat or where I'm going. And eventually the person in charge in the cabin says, Mr. Lodewijk, you just wait here, we'll see now what happens and see what door you're going to sit at. That little seat by the door, I mean, I wouldn't even let my grandson sit there. But I'm prepared to do it. And while I'm standing there, you know, say, okay, the door is shut, you know, the other people has been turned away, and there's only one more person to come, and then we're leaving. And of course, that person doesn't come. So I get that seat, and don't even have to sit on a jump seat. So, and that's why I called God the great interventionist, because he intervenes. And he intervenes on your and my behalf if we serve him and believe him and trust him. He does it. And I've seen it over and over and over in situations where I have no way out, only God and whoever else is the instrument that he uses. So there I'm sitting, traveling. Nice, I got a wonderful seat, place for my stretching of my legs, and the purser, they call him, the first man, he comes in there, he says, I wish I had a seat for you in premier class, you know, but if anything, but I can't, so this is the next best, and it was a lovely seat, he says, but, you know, we'll serve you well, even from the business class to the economy class, he says, and here, take this, so that if you come to London, this is for you to go through the fast track, a privilege note. So I come to the airport and it's full of people standing there. And here I'm going, Mr. Man, I'm going to the fast lane to just go through customs and everything. Then I think, my, from having your back to the wall, having no way out, here you are in the front line getting the privileges all. Does he intervene? Oh, yes, he is. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. Thank you for having me again. And let me just say, I've had, as I mentioned, the privilege of launching my biography of the many years of service by His grace. And I've brought a few copies if anybody are interested to have them. It's at, I think the last time they told me, it was £16. It's not an autobiography, it's a biography. It's written by my granddaughter. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It's called Love, Life, and Lessons Learned. Or Life, Love, and Lessons Learned, something like that. But I sometimes think the lessons learned should be in front. And it's always more advantageous and cheaper to learn from somebody else's mistakes. And I've made some, and you can have it, you know, learn from the mistakes. I won't charge you for the mistakes, but we'll charge you for the book. So there's a lot of pictures in there, my life, in the church, in missions, in planting, in mentoring, in sport, the sport world, in the political world, wherever, where God has intervened numerous times, and I trust it will be a blessing to you. That's the end of the commercial. And if somebody so much like to have it, but they haven't got the money, all right, just talk to me, you know, I know people. Let me say to you that I've had a request and say I can speak on any subject I want, but, you know, I should also consider the request of speaking in the line of life in the family. And I spoke for 2 hours on that in Franschhoek, but I'm not going to speak on that. But I am going to speak on a subject which I have sat with these last few days, and I believe God has something in mind to encourage you. And my sermon this morning, or my talk, I would say this morning, will be in the form of a question. And it will be a question that asks you, how's your vineyard? How's your vineyard? Do you say vineyard here or vineyard? Are you in the wine industry? But I think vineyard is well understood. And I'm going to read from a book in the Bible which most of you very spiritual people doesn't read. You pass over when you're done because you regard it as, you know, too fleshly. Some of it even speaks about it being pornography. And so they don't read that. And then there are the others again that mostly speak in Christianese instead of English. And they would regard this as simply a book that is intended to be a picture of Christ and His bride and His people. Yes, it can be a picture. But the story itself about Solomon and the Shunammite is more than just a picture of Jesus and the bride. It is an actual story of life. And I want to take my talk, talking about life and family and such, marriage. I want to use Songs of Solomon this morning with your permission. No hands? Okay, then I'm safe. Songs of Solomon, the word that I get there in the 8th chapter, the 12th verse, says something. It says, my own vineyard is before me. My own vineyard is before me. But before, it comes to the 8th chapter, obviously, and it starts off with this story of Solomon's song. A song that is regarded and it is written and called the magnum opus. The number one, the greatest of all of his songs and poems that he has written. Now, if you say it's the best out of 3,000 Proverbs and 1,005 Psalms, then it must be something special. Now this is a song, conversation, communication between this young lady who is still within her mother's care and Solomon before he becomes, and then onward while he becomes the king. And we read there that this song compares with anything else and exceeds so much, but it is a conversation between this Lebanese farm girl turned queen and the king himself, Solomon. In the early part, you find this girl saying something, and it writes a picture. And she says in chapter 1, verse 6, it says, the dark and lovely young lady. I am sure she's dark because she is spending all those long hours in the sun caring for the family vineyard. She says in 1 verse 6, my mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, of their vineyards. And then she says, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Now here you have a picture of the sons, which in those days has always been regarded as the higher, and the girls the lower, and they are there at the becking and call of the mother and the brothers and all. And these brothers are doing their thing, and she cares for their vineyard. No wonder she is dark as a Lebanese girl. And she's there in the burnt sun every day caring for the sons of this mother at her mother's beckoning, at the son's beckoning. And then she starts this communication to and fro with her beloved. And this telling and calling and one after another conversation between three. It's the Shunammite, the girl in love, Solomon, the man in love, and then there's a chorus group on the sides there that sometimes bring their voice into it too. It's no wonder we know that if there are any life between a lover and a lover, then there's always a third party that comes with the best advice and such. But the conversation and the song and the singing is between these three. Most of it between the Shunammite and King Solomon. And to and fro goes it in chapter 8 verse 12. She tells us about how the change came along. From chapter 8 to chapter 12, now a mature woman within the safety of marriage, she was under Solomon's care, and she says, now my own vineyard is before me. Now, this is the difference between the first statement of Sir Solomon's 1 and First Solomon 8. The First Solomon 1 says, my own vineyard I have not cared for. And then, cared for her own vineyard by after marriage and such, and she says, my own vineyard is now before me. Now, when I see this picture of this dear, precious young lady, very much in love, conversating with Solomon, and all of that she's doing while she's still probably at her spare time, or maybe while she's in the vineyard there, now and then starts singing or conveying, and she didn't have email at the time, and she didn't tweet once, she just had to get a message to him by some way that she can send this message to and fro so that there's communication between them. But the hindrance was that she was the one who cared for mom's vineyard, for elder brother's vineyard, for younger brother's vineyard, whatever her name was, and not caring for her own particular vineyard. There already you find something That is what is very similar to what is happening in our world today, because everybody is busy. The sad part is we're part of a world that we're more busy with somebody else's vineyard than we are with our own vineyard. Our own vineyard is really our marriage and our family. That's the primary concern as far as God is concerned, and should be as far as we are concerned. And then, as much as we can, we will care for the neighbor's vineyard. We will care for a friend's vineyard, but not at the cost of our own vineyard. What a beautiful day it was after all of those singing the songs and the exchange of ideas and how they feel about one another. Beautiful. I read this particular Songs of Solomon over and over and over and over, and I feel like a 24-year-old. Why 24? It's more or less the time when I got married the first time. It was because it somehow freshens your marriage. It freshens your life. It makes you realize that there's more to life than just every single word in Christianese, and we never want to say anything to anybody else in English. Now you're saying, what are you talking about Christianese? I'm talking about people that are a bit more spiritual than me. I'm not very spiritual. You know, I'm a child of the Lord and I walk close to God, but I sometimes speak English. The problem with so many of us, we want to do everything spiritual. And we never realize that we are human. We are human beings, and we got to care for the things that needs attention here, which is more than speaking in tongues and singing a song to God. It's important that we keep our feet on the ground. Don't misunderstand me when I say more than speaking to God. We always speak to God first. We honor Him first. But our problem was that in the times, at least that I grew up, and it may still be around in some areas, that there is the perception that God is first, and there we all agree. But we don't agree on the second one, that ministry is then second. Ministry, whatever kind of ministry, whether it be secular, whether you are in ministry at work, wherever it may be, that always comes after family. And the fact that it has been placed above family values and marriage, that have got whatever is left over. I've said it to the people in Franschhoek. I grew up at a time when mothers used to give testimony in church. You know, they don't do it so much anymore. But they would have a testimony time in church, something like 40 or 20 minutes or so. Not 40, 20 minutes, 15 minutes. And they'll have three or four people coming to give testimony. And these dear, precious, wonderful spiritual mothers would come up on fire for God, speaking in tongues, and they would get up and say, "Brothers and sisters, for me, I am going to serve the Lord, and nothing is going to stop me serving the Lord. I have told my husband, I have told my children, if they want to go to hell, they can go to hell, but I'm going to follow Jesus." Oh my. I would cringe sometimes, even as a young man sitting there. I'm not going to send my children to go to hell, and my husband and my wife go to hell, and then for ministry. God has never called me to that. God has called me to honor Him above everything and everybody, to make Him first above everything, but after that, definitely comes family and marriage. Very, very, very important. I know they did it, you know, they meant well, but it's definitely not expressed very well. I have often said to pastors, when I was elected to be the moderator in the AFM church in South Africa, the pastors told me that, listen, now that you're in this position, you've got to be respectful to that position, you've got to honor that position, and you now got to stop carrying the chairs at the conferences and put some tables on your head and things like that. You're now the moderator. I said, okay, just show me where I can resign this position. I want to do it as quickly as I can. And after a long talk, to and fro, I persuaded them that I will be just the person that I am and nothing more. And no position will rob me of what I humanly want to do for people and for Christ. They agreed under duress. They somehow agreed me still to have my position, and I can carry chairs on my head. So I was happy. The problem was that there was always this kind of idea that we so got to honor the positions that I have as pastors, as leaders, at whatever we were doing, because that is equal to God. What we do for God is not equal to God. God is God. He gets all the glory, gets all the honor, He gets our worship, our praise, our admiration, our living for Him. And we stay in touch with Him. My favorite pastime is not in the morning in devotion. My favorite pastime is early in the morning before the sun comes up. I'm a walker. I can't run like you do. I can walk. I used to run a bit, but now I walk. I slow down slightly. I'm over 40 now. In the morning, walk for 3.5 kilometers, and I do it again in the evening wherever I am. I will walk here. I know all the where I'm staying at the guest house. I know that whole area from walking every time I come here. I love it because that's my conversation time. My walking time, good exercise, but my conversation time, where I can have a chat with my Heavenly Father and just talk about life to Him, you know. What I think of life, what I would still want out of life. I love it. I regard Him as the Alpha and the Omega. But I do not regard being the person in the church and the pastor and doing the ministry work as being equal to God. God is first. But doing things for everybody around and not caring for the most important, my family, my marriage. That is what robbed our world of what we should have had or could have. I'm all for ministry. I love ministry. I preached my first sermon when I was 14 years old. Glad they don't have the tapes available today. But I love doing it. God's work. I planted churches. I enjoy it. It's fantastic. But I will not have that at the cost of my family. Now, let me show you a picture of what God's method and pattern should be. In 1 Kings 5, verse 13, and you can read it later. And it shows Solomon's wisdom that God has blessed him with. 1 Kings 5 verse 13 says, "Then Solomon raised up a labor force out of Israel. And the labor force was 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 per month in shifts. And were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home." Let me paint the picture for you. Solomon has been honored to build the temple for God. His father, David, was denied that privilege. We know it. One of his first tasks would be to build this temple for God, where the ark can be, where God will be worshipped and honored. So he's got to build this temple, but what he needs is to get some of the best wood that is needed for this temple. He needs this wood. But there is a fascinating story here that there is a neighboring king who is not a Christian. He's the king of Hiram. He's offering a service to Solomon. And he says, okay, I know your father. And because of who he was, I'm prepared to offer you cedar wood and all the wood that you need. I can give it to you, some of the cypress logs, and so you can have it. But you have to provide the labor force for it, then you can have it. Because the best of the cedar was in Lebanon. So, Solomon, with the wisdom that God has given him, and he's having his priority right, he says, okay, I am preparing 30,000 men to come and work and prepare that those logs, those wood pieces, so that it be coming across so that we can start building the temple for God. But this is what he will do, he says, I will have 30,000 of them, but I will send 10,000 per month so that they can be 1 month in Lebanon to cut the blocks and prepare the blocks, and they will be 2 months at home. What picture do you see there? I see a picture of a wise person that says, yes, they're going to work hard. I'm going to give them this instruction that they must come and prepare the logs, whether they work day and night, whether they work Saturday, Sunday, Monday, if they had all of those days in place. They can work, but they work 1 month and they're home for 2 months. In other words, he's saying, I want them home twice as much as what they will be working in the field. What it says is a principle that is wise that comes from this man, which literally says to you, it is wise to spend twice as much of your time in the benefit of your family, your marriage, than it is to spend it there in preparing to build the temple or your workplace. Today, many of us, especially as men, the least time we can spend at home, the better. Because we blame it on all kinds of things. We blame it on the nagging wife. We blame it on, the children. We blame it on one thing or another. Whereas God's principle is that you spend time in what is really, really, really special. Now, you and I cannot do anything about yesterday. We cannot do much about today because it's almost gone. But we can prepare to be valuable tomorrow. And if we are going to be valuable tomorrow, are we going to be valuable in the future? I'm saying we can't contribute to yesteryear. We can't. It's past. Opportunities are gone. What our fathers and our mothers did or missed is gone. Whether we got to do reparations work these days or whatever it may be, what we got to realize that we are in a place where we are prepared by God for the next generation. I run a program called Next in Line. Next in Line, we prepare the next in line to prepare the next in line. And we take 45 pastors, leaders, for 3 days while we talk about yesteryear. What we missed out, what perhaps the generation that passed us missed out. How can we now make sure that the future is more secure because of our contribution? And our contribution is smaller outside than what it is inside the family. Our greatest contribution of wanting to secure tomorrow is to do well at home and not to do well in our banking, in our what or whatever. It's good. That's things that must be done. But the foundation of the people tomorrow lies with those who are here today. And within those people of today, the people within the church, the Christians, the greater their communication or commitment or today to their families, the better hope we have for tomorrow. It is said that where we are today, the stats is absolutely scary. Very, very scary. 40% of children today live without their biological father. And in some cities, the figure climbed to 80% live a fatherless life. I walk and is seen or perceived to be a mentor to the person who heads up the organization, The World Needs a Father. And he travels the globe bringing this message. He's got people employed everywhere providing assistance and stats like these that scare you about what is happening out there. And all of this research that has been done shows that it is because that there was a neglect of some kind within the home, primarily by the father. 85% of children with behavioral problems come from fatherless homes. 85%. 90% of homeless children come from fatherless homes. 71% of children not finishing school comes from fatherless homes. According to Stephen Baskerville of Howard University, 63% of children attempting suicide come from fatherless homes. In Russia, has the biggest stat. Virtually every major social pathological problem has been linked to fatherlessness: violence, drugs, alcohol abuse. Teenage pregnancy of all of these correlate more strongly to fatherlessness than to any other single factor. Stats that scare you, and these stats are already a month or two or three old. It's probably now increased as it goes on. That's the world that we have now as a consequence of yesteryear. You and I can do nothing about what yesterday, but we can do something about tomorrow. We can do something about changing our world, our little world within a greater world. And there is no greater instrument in turning things around than the church. Why? Because the church has somebody that works with them. The church knows somebody that can make this possible. Our God, our Lord. The church has to stand up. The church has to live beyond the walls. The church has to live beyond the walls where they are contained to sing the lovely, lovely, beautiful Christian songs. Keep on singing it. But let us model Jesus well where we walk, where we work. Let us wear him well. Let us model him. Let our language and our walk talks about who he is to change things. It is for us so important to do that. I was part just a few days ago after Stellenbosch, part of the launch of a educational leadership academy being launched. And I listened to the professor, the rector of the Free State University, brilliant man, absolutely brilliant man, speaking there. I was honored to be just a sort of a support speaker. But to listen to him about family, and what made him successful, and what he believes, for he talks about, I have 30,000 children, he says. At university, that's my children. I have those children. He says, but I also have the children who is my flesh and blood. He says, the one is getting married. He says, his son that's going to get married came to him and said, Dad, I want you, it's time that you meet the family of my wife to be in 2 weeks' time. We're getting married. You got to get to know them. And he's been going out for them for a while, but the parents have not. And he says, Dad, promise me that you will not embarrass me when you get there. Saying this to a professor who's the rector at the university. And he said, I'll do my best, son. And he went to meet the in-laws. And now Professor Johnson is a colored in South Africa, but a very dark skin colored. I'm the one that's been kept out of the sun. I'm a little bit lighter. But he went to meet the family. And when he got there, he said to the family, he says in a nice voice, jocular voice, he says to them, are you sure that you can accept my son as an Afrikaner family? He's a dark boy. And he was waiting for a response. And his mother-in-law to be got up, and she turned not to Johnson's family but to her family, and she said to them, is any among you racist? Put up your hand. Nobody put up their hand. You could see this is a powerful mother. Johnson said he felt so good, and he said, let us welcome one another into one another's family. That the mother, Afrikaner, coming from a real Afrikaner state somewhere in the Boere district, says to her family, is any among you racist here? And nobody, everybody just smiled, and she says, we one family. And the way he spoke there, he said, because when they followed up, they said, we're doing this conversation because these two must begin to prepare for a future. And what they do, they must model as they walk from here. They married now. They are a happy couple. And they're getting on well with the mother-in-laws or the father-in-laws. Why am I saying this? I'm saying that we should take care that we break down anything that stands in our way of modeling Jesus the way we should be modeling him. Anything. And let the world see the church. Let the world see the church. Now, I am blessed to have a family. Should I have stopped already? No. Okay. Nobody's keeping time. What time do you have lunch? 4 o'clock? No. Okay. I'm blessed to have been married to the love of my life, Mary. I was married to her for 52 years, and what a marriage, what a love life. I think we grew more romantic as we grew older. I think when we were married 50 years, we were like as if we were married now for 2 or 3 years. I'm not saying that because I was an angel. I'm only saying that God has given me grace to make up for the years that I have not known about. You see, I have never heard my father say any kind of pet name or any romantic name to my mother. I've never seen him holding her hand. I've never seen him kissing her. I've never seen anything, because those are not things that children should be seeing in those years, you see. So whether they kissed or not, I suppose they did. I mean, they still had 7 children, but the fact remains, it was not for children to be seen. So there was nowhere a modeling of a love that belongs in the family of a husband and wife. So when I got married here just before 24 years old, and with this lady, I had to somehow wonder how certain things are done. Now, yes, you can read it in the, see it in the movies, and you can read it in the books also, but you've never where you should be seeing it is by your parents. There's some things you learn, but some things is carried over. By God's grace, I managed to quickly couple on, and my wife was the kind of person that you can hook onto, and it was beautiful. God took her away from me to take her to heaven. She was too good for me. Only good enough for heaven about a year and a half ago, and I'm still learning to live alone. But, you know, I believe that it was important for me to not... I loved my father. Wonderful father. I loved my mom. She was a beautiful, lovely person. She was soft. I mean, if you took her and put her on her head, she'd probably stay there and not rebel. But she was a lovely person. But they did not model a life of love. There was no Solomon songs in there. There was no. So I come onto the scene and have to now prepare with Mary a family in a different vein. It took a few years. It took time. But what a special journey it was of discovery. A journey of discovery. I think we were more romantic, as I said, and more in love when we were married 50 years than any time before. Yes, we couldn't go on honeymoon when we got married. There's no such a thing. It doesn't exist. We didn't know if it was in the dictionary, but for us, we are concerned, there's no such thing. You get married on a Saturday, you go to church on a Sunday twice, and then you go to work on a Monday. What more are you looking for? But I did say to her, one day we are going on honeymoon. And she was probably looking out for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years came. But I said to her, every time such a year came, the right time to go, I said, one day we go in. One day we can make it. Because we poor. We were poor people. Because even the poor people called us poor. But one day we go on honeymoon. And I knew that one day as I grew, what her love was, that she loved river cruising. Not cruising on an ocean liner, but cruising on river boats. And I said, one day, we go in. 15 came, no. 20 years came, no. Then came 25 years. I said, we're ready to go on honeymoon. We go on a honeymoon 25 years after marriage. It's better after 25 years. I've learned a few things. I've learned a few things. I'm wiser now. I'm more romantic than I've ever been before. And we go and we cruise on 7 rivers in 7 countries in Europe. As we cruised, the river cruise, it was a dream come true for her. And from there, it was honeymoon every year, all the time, every day. Why am I saying this? I realized that I got to lay a foundation for those coming after me. And because I had almost no education, to those of you who read my old book, Love in a Hate Situation, you would know that I had almost no situation, no education. I was a shack dweller. I lived in a stable with my family. They let the horses out, gave us the stable to live in. When Jesus found me, he found me in a stable. That's what, one thing we got in common. We both lived in a stable. Because we lived in the wrong area with the wrong color, we were thrown out and no alternative accommodation. But people gave us a stable to live in. In that stable, I found Jesus. And he turned things around. No education. I got to work at what I want. God granted me the grace and mercy to help to restore the years that the locust has eaten. And I got something. I studied at night. I studied this until I went to theological college. I studied. I did all I can to make up because my children are not going to be and only be satisfied with what I have. And God has honored that. God has honored that. And in my simple way, humble way, I managed to succeed in more things that I failed. I have said to my children, if your children don't go beyond you, you're a failure. I would regard myself as a failure if my children don't go beyond me. With very little education, with hard work, getting and working to get it. Today, I'm thrilled. I'm excited. I'm honored to see my children have gone beyond me. When I watch the sport on television and I see the Lord of Egg name there, I say, there's another one that you know here. Senior producer on television. I said, she's made it. Pa didn't make it, my daughter has made it. When I hear my young son fly and I sit in the aircraft and I hear, this is your senior first officer, Chris Lodewijk, speaking, I say, yes, he made it. I'm not a failure. He made it. I didn't make it. He made it. And so it goes on and on and on. And today, I'm proud to be the father of my four children, the father of 8 grandchildren, and the father of 2 great grandchildren. And all of them that have since by now served the Lord, except for the 2 little ones, which are too young, 2 and 3 years old. They will also serve the Lord. The others are all serving the Lord in the marketplace. I'm thrilled. I did not have to just be limited to what my father gave, which was his best. I must get better so that my tomorrow must be rewarded so that I can live. My own vineyard I have not cared for. I've cared for the neighbor, the brothers, and so. Now she says, now my own vineyard is before me. I want to say to you that our own vineyards needs special care. God expected. I'm coming to a close, not going to 4 o'clock. When I read those words in Luke 10, verse 25, we find Jesus in conversation with a certain lawyer, a student of the Mosaic law, a scribe. His question was intended to trap Jesus. He had sufficient knowledge of the word, the scribe, to ask God a question like this. But he didn't know how to apply it. The question was, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Seemed a straightforward question for somebody seeking. But it's the response of Jesus that stands out for me. Jesus' response is this: you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. With all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all of your mind. Not with either your heart or your soul. Not with one of the 4. Not of some of them. But you shall love the Lord with all 4. With your heart. Praise God. To keep that right with God. With all of your soul, which is so important, to love God there. Each of these facets of my being are completely unseen to the eye, but they are important. All of your heart. It's not the part that the doctors handle, doctor, and the other part of the heart. It is that part that you cannot see. It's that part that modern equipment can't reach, but that God softens and that God prepares for the life that I have. put all of your soul, that inner self, that psyche, that inner being, the life source, that soul, the vital force, the individuality, the makeup, the subconscious, that soul, love him with all that. Is Jesus asking much? I think he does. And have earned, and have expect, and demand of us much. All of your strength, that human source of energy, that symbol of endurance and of perseverance, all of your strength. But I want to stop for just a little while before I let you go with all of your mind. That seat of consciousness, of thought, of volition, of feeling, all of your mind. I'm not sure that we sometimes get to that. I think we sometimes get to the three. Man, we love God. Man, our heart is so full of God. We love him with our soul, our very being. We love him with that. I'm not so sure with the mind sometimes. Because we sometimes regard the mind as being a fleshly thing. Sometimes, I think I've said it before, I don't know if I've said it here, sometimes people have that idea that the mind is a gift, a talent that God has given us, and that we got to protect it and care for it and make sure that we don't do anything with it before we die, so that when we get there we can come to Jesus and say, Lord, you gave me this brain, thank you so much, and I've cared for it, I've watched it, I didn't want to tarnish it, I didn't want to do anything with it, so it's brand new, I haven't used it, I'm just bringing it to you like this, so that I return it to you as you gave it to me. You can see that I've been faithful in trusting and keeping this brain so lovely, so pure. You can see it's brand new, Lord, just as you gave it to me. That's not why he gave it to us. He actually gave it to us that we use it. And that when we come before him, it will be so used, man. It's not even second-hand, it will be third, fourth-hand. Because we've used it on every occasion. Men especially. You men can be dumb. Not you, I mean other men. They don't always use this in here for what works, what succeeds. I think men are the only sex of men, of the two, that sometimes even the 15th time he doesn't realize it doesn't work. He keeps on believing the 16th time it's going to work. You know, when something is wrong, it can never be right. You've got to discard what is wrong and accept the right. You can never make the wrong right. You've got to leave it and do a fresh new thing which is right. I'm not saying, ladies, that you are always innocent, but anyway, I'm giving you grace today. The fact remains that there is so much dependent on us, and especially men, that priestly figure that is there to make sure that we have a better tomorrow. And in order to succeed therein, we've got to use what God has blessed us with, the mind. 1 Timothy 5 verse 5 says, the purpose of my instruction is that all Christians, they would be filled with a love that comes from a pure heart, a clear conscience, and sincere faith. A clear conscience and sincere faith. Jeremiah's message to the people of Judah and Jerusalem was to remind them of the terms of the covenant. The Lord of hosts, who judges righteously, who tests the heart and the mind. David's prayer for his son, no wonder he succeeded his early life. Later, it was a little bit different. Of course, you can expect that with 700 wives. But David's prayer for his son Solomon was, he says, as for you, my son Solomon, know the Lord of your Father and serve Him with a loyal heart, which is also a perfect heart, and a willing mind. They keep on saying and pushing the mind in there. 2 Timothy 1 verse 7 teaches us, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." It repeats, and I can give you another half a dozen scriptures, but I think you're listening, that what is so important is not so much that we be filled with more spirit. Yes, yes, get it as much as you can. But that we start being sensible in preparing ourselves for tomorrow. And if we have failed in some areas, to believe that failure is not fatal. Failure is not fatal, as long as you fail forward. Just don't fail backward. Fail forward. And if you do fail forward, it means that you are actually, the next time, you've learned from that, and you're not going to fail over the first thing that you did. And God help us, because we need the church to stand and step into the spot where we can be that agent of change in our community. And there's no better place to have it and start is to start with the family. You know, I don't want to mention so much of the family, but it's only my testimony. I haven't got your testimony, another person's testimony. I've got mine. My greatest joy is watching my children. Much more than I watch them as the married ones. My granddaughter is married, and I see them, and I see their love life. Well, not all, everything, but I mean, I see their lives, and I see my daughters, my sons, and I see them getting they married, and I enjoy when I know they married 25 years, and they married 30 years, and they married 15 years, and go strong. I love to see that. It is a witness, and my prayer now is that my two youngest grandchildren, they were the youngest, and they of my youngest son, the baby son, his children are only 8 and 10, and they are the two small ones, but they are already aunties, because they are great grandchildren, to see them grow up serving Christ, but also modeling a life in the family that can make me proud. God grant grace that all of us may prepare for tomorrow. That we will care for our vineyard. Yes, you can care for somebody else's vineyard, but not at the cost of your own vineyard. My own vineyard, she says, is now before me. Solomon, the wise one. Yes, he slipped a little bit later. But that period of his life where God gave him that wisdom that he asked for, what a blessing. And buried in all of that wisdom that God gave him came this, where his wife can say, "Now, my own vineyard is before me." May God grant that our lives may be successful in every way, and not only in the secular work that we do, but we will succeed first of all in knowing Him, in serving Him, and secondly, that we will begin to build the model, to build that model of family life, of marriage life, that will prepare our future. Anybody here not married? Oh boy, many of you. My deepest sympathy. I'm saying that jokingly, you know. Why am I saying that? I almost regard people that's not... I think so much of marriage that when I see somebody not married, I almost feel sorry. No. Not in a bad way. Because marriage is so special. And for you who are not married, prepare well. Prepare well. Learn as much as you can. Some of you may have learned, but learn as much as you can. Prepare yourself well, because when you step into it, let it be something of a model that others can say, That's the life I want. May God bless you in marriage. May God bless you in preparation for marriage. May God bless you in your life, whatever stage it may be, that you will know Him who really wants to ensure tomorrow through you. God bless you. I love you.
How many years to get 10,000 days? How many years to make 10,000 days? Anyone? Last teacher, no pressure. How many? 20? 40? 30? How many?